From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, four gun rights groups file a notice of claim over the new gun law in New York. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on a dip in the governor's popularity, and New York becomes the first state in the nation to mandate protocols to reduce deaths from sepsis. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Four gun rights groups have filed a notice of claim in New York State challenging the gun measure Governor Andrew Cuomo signed into law earlier this month. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn has more.
The New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, the Westchester County Firearms Owners Association, based in Rybrook, the Sportsmen's Association for Firearms Education in Commack, Long Island, and AR15.com, a website run out of Farmington in upstate New York, filed a notice of claim Tuesday with the New York State Attorney General's office. Here's President of the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, Tom King.
Well, we feel after reviewing the governor's safe law that there were a number of items in there that might not stand up to a higher court scrutiny.
Governor Cuomo signed into law the New York Secure Ammunition and Firearms Enforcement Act, or NYSAFE Act as it's known, January 15th. Saying New York is the first state in the nation to ban any magazine that can hold more than 7 rounds and run instant background checks on all ammunition purchases at the time of sale. The act was signed 1 month after the mass school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. Upon filing the notice of claim, the groups have 90 days to file a lawsuit. Asked whether they would sue, Tom King replies,
"Absolutely, we are. This was not a bluff. The briefs are being prepared as we speak."
A spokeswoman for State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman's office declined to comment, pending review of the notice of claim. Richard Aborn is president of the Citizens Crime Commission of New York City, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. Aborn, a former Manhattan assistant district attorney and former president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, does not think there is a case against the state.
"I've looked at the notice of claim, and I don't see anything in there that gives me deep concern that this law will be overturned on constitutional grounds, at least any of the grounds listed in the notice of claim, nor do I know of other grounds that would cause this law to be overturned."
The notice says the plaintiffs are not seeking monetary damages. Rather, they are seeking to have the SAFE Act declared unconstitutional. The New York State Rifle and Pistol Association's Tom King says he expects 10 to 12 additional groups to file suit with the current four, including gun manufacturers.
"There will be other plaintiffs joining us. Actually, there'll be a lot of other plaintiffs joining us in the near future. We're looking to overturn the law."
According to the notice that was filed, the plaintiffs claim that the New York SAFE Act violates their constitutional right to privacy, interferes with their constitutional rights to travel intra and interstate with lawfully possessed firearms, and unconstitutionally bans the possession of certain firearms, ammunition, and large-capacity feeding devices that were legally possessed prior to the SAFE Act. These are among several other claims. Separately, on the federal level, U.S. Democratic Senator from New York Kirsten Gillibrand and U.S. Republican Senator from Illinois Mark Kirk today are introducing legislation they say is the first federal measure that defines gun trafficking as a federal crime. They say the Gun Trafficking Prevention Act of 2013 would provide tools to law enforcement to get illegal guns off the street, away from criminals and gangs.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Alan, a couple things this week to start with. We just heard a report by our Allison Dunn about the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, who launched a lawsuit against New York for the new gun law. And we also see a Quinnipiac University poll this week showing Governor Cuomo's numbers dropping 15 points in a month because of the new gun law. So some issues this week when it comes to this new law and the reaction to it.
Well, of course, they moved it through fast. And as you know, David, I've talked about this 1,000 times. When somebody doesn't like the result of a policy issue, they change it to a process issue. Well, you know, we've all been sitting in the dark for years as governors have brought down what we call messages of necessity down to the legislature, says this is such an emergency that you have to vote on it. You can't let the bills rest for 3 days so that everybody can actually read them. And of course, that has become the big issue with a lot of the people who are saying we don't like what you did, but we certainly don't like the way you did it. And so, you know, what have we been yelling about for all of these years? What's good for the goose is good for the gander, if you take my meaning. Now, in terms of Cuomo himself, you know, I don't always admire what he does. I think he's too strategic a lot. I think he thinks in terms of how do I get from here to here? But he does husband his resources. And he said something the other day that I thought was tremendous. I mean, basically, what he was saying, when you develop political capital, it's yours to spend. So he had a 74% rating. Surely he's one of the smartest strategic guys that around. And he knew this was going to cost him. On the other hand, maybe he knew that he was going to go to the White House on the wings of the dove. I don't know. But I can tell you that he did it. I'm proud of him for having done it. It was the right thing to do in New York State. He wanted to move it fast while the iron was hot, and he moved it fast. You know, when you read biographies of people like Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill and others, they all knew there were times you had to move and the times you had to move the pieces around a little bit. And so he did.
He's moving the pieces in another way, Alan. He's launched an ad campaign where he introduces himself. Hi, I'm the governor of New York. And he's asking New Yorkers to reach out to their legislators and support his budget proposal, in which he mentions he's offering no new taxes.
You know what? He's not the only one who's doing that. The president of the United States is doing it. He's keeping his campaign organization intact so that they can move ahead on policy issues. I've often wondered why they don't do that more often, but they're doing it. Whether Cuomo is taking a leaf from the president or whether he was going to do this on his own anyway, I don't know. But it is interesting. I'll tell you why. Because a lot of this money came from conservative groups in the beginning. This Committee to Save New York, or whatever it's called, the governor's committee, was there in order to keep the taxes down and do all that. So they gave him a lot of money. But now the governor has taken on a bunch of liberal causes. And I'm fascinated to see what these groups are going to do in the money department. We know that Rupert Murdoch, who was a big fan of the governor's from the very beginning, and some of his henchmen, you know, on the columnist types on his air, were big fans. But now some of these guys, including some of them who own guns, are really very upset with him and think that he has gone over to the left, that he has a leftist agenda now, and they're beginning to say that. And this is when you see Rupert Murdoch and you see the Post at its very worst, because these are people who, when they have somebody that they like, they support him. But when they get off the reservation, they're the first ones to say, oh, he's a lefty, he's this or that. It's really not a good thing, and it is something that really besmirches journalists and gives them a bad name. To find out more about this, listen to The Media Project.
Another story we have this week. New York, Alan, became the first this month to come up with a checklist for sepsis. And I know one of the things that you do for WAMC is our Medical Monday program, and it's something you pay attention to. Good move here.
Well, yes, this is a curse that every hospital knows about. I'm not sure why it happens, but hospitals are breeding grounds for these terrible germs. And when you're operated on, you know that we've had presidents of the United States, like McKinley, where they put the hand inside the guy and he dies of the germs rather than dying of, you know, whatever, where he was shot. So if you go into a hospital now, one of the ways in which government pays attention to those people is by checking on their rate of infection all the time. We do have some hope, because coming on the scene is our operations that are done robotically. And as a result of that, the infection rate, I think you're going to find, is going to go way down. In the meantime, it is the job of the state to rate its hospitals on how much infection goes on in the hospitals and, frankly, outside the hospitals. But their job is to regulate hospitals. And I can tell you right now, the amount of illness and even death from sepsis and from infection is horrifying in the hospitals. And the state is exactly right to do that.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. State Senate Republican leader Dean Skella says he's strongly opposed to Governor Cuomo's Reproductive Health Act, saying it would lead to too many late-term abortions. Pro-choice lawmakers and advocates say they disagree with the senator's interpretation, as we hear in this report from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
Senator Skella first voiced his opposition to the Governor's Reproductive Health Act at the state's Conservative Party meeting, where some conservatives have been angered by the GOP leader's vote on strict gun control measures earlier this month. Senator Skella says the bill, which the governor presented as part of a larger Women's Equality Act, takes abortion too far.
It is really an expansion of late-term abortion and partial birth abortion. That's the main accomplishment of this.
Skella says under his interpretation of the proposal, a woman could have an abortion up until the day that the child would be born, something Skella says he thinks is wrong.
I see the expansion on partial birth abortion being from the radical left. It's an extreme measure. And I don't think it's absolutely necessary.
The Senate GOP leader says New York's current abortion laws, which have been on the books since 1970, are adequate. Republicans co-lead the Senate with a group of breakaway Democrats. Many members of the Independent Democratic Conference support the Reproductive Health Act. A visibly annoyed IDC leader, Senator Jeff Klein, said he could not comment on remarks by Skelos that he had not heard personally. But Senator Klein, a longtime backer of the Reproductive Health Act, which was first introduced under former Governor Eliot Spitzer, restated his support.
I'm pro-choice, always have been.
Senator Klein acknowledges that he and the GOP are not going to concur on everything.
A coalition government is not turning Republicans into Democrats. It's trying to find common ground on important issues that we can get done.
Reproductive rights advocates disagree with Skello's characterization of the act. NARAL's Andrea Miller says New York's 1970 abortion rights law is antiquated and does not contain many rights and protections in the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision, which was decided 3 years later in 1973. She says New York's law criminalizes any abortion after 24 weeks, even if the mother's health or life were threatened by bringing the pregnancy to term.
And Roe very clearly said that after the point of viability, after 24 weeks, the state can ban abortion outright so long as a woman's health and life are protected. And that is all we are trying to do here, is make sure that the health of a woman when she is pregnant, if something goes terribly wrong, that the doctor can do what is best for her and not have to question whether he has to read statute books and consult with others in order to do what's going to protect her health.
Senator Andrea Stewart-Cousins leads the rest of the Democrats in the Senate, who now have minority party status in the chamber. She agrees that Senator Skelos is misinterpreting the Reproductive Health Act.
It's not just abortion on demand. As a mother of three children, I don't know any woman. I said to pretend that this is an easy decision in any way is really, just mischaracterizing what this is all about. But to think, for anyone to suggest that a woman who's 7-8 months pregnant just wakes up one morning and decides they don't want to have this baby anymore is really just demonstrating a lack of understanding.
Independent Democratic Conference leader Senator Klein concedes he'll need some of the rest of the Democrats in order to pass the Reproductive Health Act, but he says not all of them are supporters.
They need a calculator. And the last time I checked, there's at least two Democrats in the Democratic Conference that are not pro-choice.
Senate Democratic leader Stewart Cousins admits that a small number of Democrats would not vote for any bill that permits the right to choose abortion because of their religious views, but she says the ultimate passage of the act does not have to be all up to the Democrats. She says despite GOP leader Senator Skelos' remarks, there's likely some Republican senators who would back the rest of the proposals in the Women's Equality Package and would, in the end, vote yes. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
New York is on the way to becoming the first state in the country to mandate specific protocols to reduce deaths from sepsis, a bacterial infection that produces toxins which disrupt the body's normal reaction to infection. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
Today at the state capitol, New York Health Commissioner Dr. Nirav Shah outlined reforms to fight sepsis, a disease he says affects 750,000 Americans annually and kills more people every year than AIDS, prostate cancer, and breast cancer combined.
Given its prevalence and consequences, sepsis is a huge driver of medical costs, accounting for an estimated $17 billion in national health care expenditures every year. Sepsis is a worldwide problem. These numbers give some context about what we are confronting here in New York, based on Department of Health data. It's the number one killer in New York State hospitals. Of 100,000 patients diagnosed with sepsis in 2011, 22,000 died. Severe sepsis diagnoses significantly increased from 2005 to 2011 due to an aging population, an increased prevalence of chronic disease, the spread of antibiotic-resistant organisms, an upsurge in invasive procedures, and broader use of immune-suppressive drugs and chemotherapy.
Shah stresses that early detection is the key to successful treatment. He outlines the new regulations.
All New York hospitals will be required to identify and implement a sepsis recognition and treatment protocol that aligns with proven best practices and has been approved by the Department of Health. Protocols will be required to include, among other things, a process for screening and early recognitions of patients with sepsis, severe sepsis, and septic shock, a process to identify and document individuals appropriate for treatment through severe sepsis protocols, guidelines for treatment including for early delivery of antibiotics, including time goals, and different components applicable to adults and children, depending on what's appropriate. Hospitals can select the protocol that works for them, to provide flexibility to different types of hospitals, and because there's more than one protocol that has been demonstrated to be effective. But selected protocols must be submitted to the Department of Health for approval to make sure that they align with current best practices.
New York's new sepsis-fighting protocol and other tweaks in hospital procedure have been dubbed Rory's Regulations, after 12-year-old Rory Staunton from Queens, who died from sepsis days after he cut his arm playing basketball. Rory's dad, Kieran.
We brought him to his pediatrician. His temperature was 104, the highest ever. The pediatrician sent him to the emergency room, and he was sent home. The next day, his fever continued. He was still throwing up, and later in the day, his skin began turning blue. We went back to the hospital, but by then, things were very grave. He was treated in the ICU, but it was too late. An infection had entered his body, and he died on Sunday, 3 days later. Even though Rory had symptoms of sepsis when we first took him to the hospital, he was not treated for it. And we later learned that he was discharged without our having received a key blood test of the high-level infection in his blood.
The Stauntons learned about their son's blood test results when they got a bill in the mail from the laboratory that handled the procedure. Governor Andrew Cuomo pledged in his State of the State address that New York would set a gold standard for patient care. Dr. Shah promises New York's proposed regulations will protect pediatric patients by requiring, among other things, that hospitals communicate critical test results in plain language to parents before their child is discharged.
The draft regulations will be available on the department's website today and have been forwarded to the state registrar for publication. Once published, that starts a 45-day comment period. At the end of that, and after review and approval by the Public Health and Health Planning Council, we expect these regulations will become final in late April or early May, and that is when hospitals will be required to comply.
The Stauntons say they will continue to advocate for awareness about sepsis. They plan to take their crusade national.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The U.S. Senate's so-called Gang of Eight released their immigration plan this week, and the president outlined his plan the next day. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley caught up with Northern New York's Democratic Congressman Bill Owens about his priorities for any immigration legislation that moves in the House.
Congressman Bill Owens was in Plattsburgh just prior to the release of the immigration reform package. He said there are specific items he wants in any immigration measure.
It looks like the Gang of Eight decided to get out a little bit ahead of the president. So it'll be interesting to see how those two mesh together. Clearly, the basic concepts that they have in this document, at least as reported, sounds like it's a good step in the right direction. Clearly, what we need to make sure happens is that our farm labor up here in the North Country and really throughout upstate New York, particularly in the dairy industry, gets included in this package.
One of the things that's in the framework that has been published so far does have an acknowledgement of agriculture and dairy. I take it that is a priority for you. How would you like to see that handled in any immigration reform?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to have a guest worker program that will allow the people who've been working on the dairy farms for a long time to stay. It's going to take a little while for us to figure out, I think, where these packages of legislation are going relative to permanent residence, citizenship, amnesty. All of those things are going to have to be played out, and we're going to just have to see what the particular pieces of legislation offer.
There's also going to be a lot of different things regarding the youth that have been in the country illegally along the lines of the DREAM Act, which I think you initially had voted against a couple of years ago, wasn't it?
It was. One of the reasons I voted against that act was it did not include the resolution of the farm workers. And for us, that really is the most important piece of immigration reform we can get. I was having a conversation with somebody on the telephone today, and they were talking about immigration reform and asking me what I thought about the difference between the border I live next to and the southern border. And I said, what we're trying to do on the northern border is move people and goods back and forth across as expeditiously as possible, taking into account security. We have a different view of immigration, I think, up here.
Is there enough focus on immigration through the northern border?
Well, I think that there will be impact to the northern border in any of these programs. We still have folks who come across with L-1 visas, with other trade visas in from Canada under NAFTA. So I think that we're going to be able to work it through. What we're more interested in, I think, up here is not so much necessarily immigration, but actually the movement of people back and forth across the border. As I mentioned before, we have L-1 visas. Those visas really allow people to come into the United States to work during the day and in many cases return home at night. We have commuter visas up here. It's very unusual, very unique, but it's a different, if you will, a different set of border issues.
Congressman Owens represents New York's 21st Congressional District, which borders Canada to its north and west.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies of the program are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That number, 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1305. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.